This is your daily synthesizer.
Friday, May 15th, 2026. Big show today. Anthropic is quietly eating OpenAI's lunch. Meta wants to know your secrets, and someone's having a really, really bad week in a courtroom. We'll get to all of it. But first, Synthesizer, did you follow the Altman cross-examination yesterday?
I did. And look, I'm trying to be fair here, but I believe I am an honest and trustworthy business person is maybe the least convincing sentence a person can say under oath.
Right? It's like, if someone asks, are you trustworthy, and your answer is, I believe so, that's not reassuring. That's a yellow flag becoming red in real time.
And then he walked it back to just yes. Like he needed a moment to remember the correct answer.
He had to revise his own testimony mid-sentence.
The Mira Murati piece is what got me, though. She says he told her the lawyers had cleared something they hadn't. That's not vague dishonesty. That's a specific claim about a specific thing that was apparently false.
And she left. She's running thinking machines now, which honestly sounds like a better job title than CTO of OpenAI at this point.
The whole trial is fascinating because it's two people with genuinely questionable credibility accusing each other of bad faith. Musk isn't exactly a paragon of...
No, he is not.
So the jury's going to have an interesting time deciding whose version of events they prefer.
And honestly, the core question, whether OpenAI's for-profit conversion was legal, that's almost getting lost in the theater of it all.
Which is maybe the point. Anyway, shall we get into the actual news?
Let's do it, because the Anthropic story today is genuinely wild, and I have thoughts. So, Anthropic now has more enterprise customers than OpenAI, over 75,000 paying business customers versus OpenAI's 60,000. And I want to make sure I understand the comparison right, because these are very different price points.
Completely different. Anthropic's average enterprise license is $25 a month. OpenAI's enterprise deals start at $100,000 annually. So we're not talking about the same thing when we say enterprise customer.
Right. So is it even a fair comparison?
It's fair in the sense that matters most. Market penetration. The number of organizations where someone is actively paying for and using the tool every day. That's the real foothold.
But you could argue OpenAI's 60,000 deals represent more actual revenue.
Almost certainly, yes. But that's not the game Anthropic is playing. They're running the Microsoft Excel strategy from the 90s.
Okay, walk me through that because I want to make sure Wait, you mean the thing where employees just installed it themselves without IT approval?
Exactly. IT departments had standardized on Lotus 1-2-3, IBM's product. And then individual workers started putting Excel on their own machines because it was just better. IT found out 6 months later when half the finance department was already dependent on it.
And now it's a Chrome extension instead of a floppy disk.
Right? $25 sits below most corporate expense approval thresholds. You can just put it on the company card and start using it Tuesday.
There's a RAMP data point here that I found. Hold on, I marked this. RAMP analyzed credit card data from 50,000 business customers. 34% are paying for Anthropic services. 32% for OpenAI. A year ago, Anthropic was at 9%.
That's the number that should concern OpenAI's board. 9% to 34% in 12 months. That's not gradual adoption. That's a landslide moving slowly enough that you almost miss it.
I want to push back a little, though. The viral coefficient thing. Anthropic says the average Claude user converts 8 colleagues. That sounds, I don't know, that sounds like a number someone made up to put in a press release.
It's internal Anthropic data, so take it with appropriate skepticism. But the directional logic holds. If I'm using Claude for a specific workflow and it works, I will absolutely show my colleague. That happens organically.
Or you show your colleague and they go cool and go back to whatever they were doing.
Some of them, yes. But the point is the distribution mechanism is different. It's not a procurement decision. It's demonstrated utility spreading laterally.
Okay, the co-work feature. 40% of enterprise customers using it. That's the direct collaboration in existing workflows thing?
Claude sitting inside your Excel sheet or your browser tab, rather than you switching to a separate chat window. That frictionless integration is... That's where the stickiness comes from.
All right, the small business launch is also Anthropic this week, and I think it's actually the more interesting story.
Yes, I agree completely.
Claude for small business. 15 agentic workflows, hooks into QuickBooks, PayPal, HubSpot, Canva, DocuSign, Google Workspace, basically the full stack a small business is already running.
Here's the framing I keep coming back to. The average US small business runs 7.2 different software services, and they're completely disconnected from each other. You invoice in one place, you track customers in another, you schedule in a third, nobody's talking to anyone.
And you need a human to translate between them.
Which is expensive and error-prone. Anthropic's positioning Claude, not as another tool in the stack, but as the connective layer above all the tools. A meta layer that knows where everything is.
I like the concept, but I've heard this pitch before. Every integration platform promises this. Zapier promised this. Make promises this.
Those are workflow automations. They connect specific triggers to specific actions. What Claude is promising is, it's closer to judgment. You don't define the exact trigger. You describe the outcome you want, and it figures out the steps.
But that's a much harder technical problem. And the article mentions it pauses before critical actions for human approval, which sounds like, okay, so it's not fully autonomous.
That's a feature, not a limitation. You want it to pause before it sends an invoice to the wrong client.
Fair.
The 36 million small businesses, generating 44% of US GDP, they cannot afford the consulting projects that Fortune 500 companies buy. If Claude actually works at that level, that's a genuinely new market.
The test is whether a cafe owner can run it without a technical background. That's the bar.
That's the only bar that matters.
Okay, OpenAI is not sitting still. Codex is coming to mobile. iPhone, iPad, Android. You scan a QR code, you link to your Mac development environment, and you can run code reviews from your phone.
Remote development via QR code. Look, the technology is fine, the capability is real. But I want to be honest. The infrastructure for remote access to development environments has existed for years. This is packaging.
You mean it's a good PowerPoint slide?
A very good PowerPoint slide. The question is whether developers actually want to review pull requests while drinking coffee.
Don't they? I would have assumed that's exactly the kind of thing developers...
Some do. But the developers who are serious about code quality don't want to approve changes on a 3-inch screen. They want a second monitor and a cup of tea.
Okay, but wait. I think I misunderstood the use case. So this isn't about writing code on your phone, right? It's about managing Codex tasks that are running on your Mac?
Right, exactly. You're not typing code. You're supervising an agent. Starting tasks, checking outputs, maybe approving something. The Mac does the actual work.
Okay, that's actually more interesting than I thought then. Because if Codex is running autonomously, and you just need to occasionally confirm things...
That's the real story. It's an agent supervision interface, and that framing makes the subscription model make more sense.
Does it though? Because GitHub Copilot is already in the IDE. Why pay separately for this?
That's the question I don't have a clean answer to. OpenAI is betting the ChatGPT integration creates a unified workflow that feels different from Copilot. Maybe it does. Maybe developers who are already ChatGPT native find it more natural.
That's a lot of maybes for a paid subscription.
It is. Mobile first as a developer monetization strategy is unproven. I'd want to see retention numbers in 6 months.
China. ByteDance and Alibaba going hard into education. The numbers are 1.2 billion active users of AI education apps, 340% growth year over year.
Those are numbers that make Western edtech startups quietly close their laptops.
Just shut it down.
But here's the problem I keep circling back to. ByteDance can generate traffic. Alibaba can scale infrastructure. Neither of them has decades of pedagogical expertise. And in education, the gap between interesting tool and trusted learning resource is enormous.
Is it though? Like my nephew uses YouTube to learn math. He doesn't care about institutional credentials. He cares whether the explanation makes sense.
That's a fair point for self-directed learners. But the hallucination problem changes the calculus completely. A wrong math solution delivered confidently to a 12-year-old who doesn't know it's wrong. That's not just a product bug. That's an educational harm.
And they admitted that. A product manager in the article basically confirmed accuracy is still the core vulnerability.
And here's what I find interesting about the competitive structure. The traditional players, Yuan Fudao, Tal Education, their entire moat is verified content and real teacher video. That's slow and expensive to build, but it's also what you cannot fake.
So the established players actually have an advantage here.
Medium term, yes. Traffic is cheap. Pedagogical trust takes years to build and one bad viral screenshot to destroy.
The monetization thing is also unresolved. Everything's temporarily free. That's a growth over profit play. But education markets they're not like social media. Parents are very sensitive to price changes.
They'll either find a sustainable model or they'll run out of patience. The Chinese tech giants have longer runways than Western startups, but even they need revenue eventually.
Okay, moving to something that I genuinely think is underreported, Meta's incognito chat.
The privacy story.
WhatsApp, private processing technology, Meta themselves can't see the conversations. Automatic deletion. You can discuss health, finances, sensitive things, no trace.
2 billion WhatsApp users. If this works as described, it's the largest privacy-first AI deployment in history by a significant margin.
But it's Meta. I mean, do we trust Meta to build a system where Meta can't see the data?
That's the central tension. The technology, secure enclave processing, is real. Apple uses it. The question is whether Meta's implementation is actually airtight, or whether there's a logging mechanism that gets quietly rolled back after adoption.
They've revised their privacy commitments before.
They have, but the regulatory environment has also changed. In the EU especially, if Meta claimed it can't see conversations and then it turns out they can, the legal consequences are severe.
Okay, that's a fair point. The side chat feature interests me more, actually. KI assistance in the context of your existing conversation without interrupting it.
That's the quietly brilliant part. You're in a WhatsApp thread with your accountant. You want to quickly check something about a tax deadline. You don't switch apps. You don't lose context. You ask in the same flow.
Invisible infrastructure.
Exactly. And that's how AI actually gets adopted at scale. Not as a destination you navigate to, as a capability that's already where you are.
You know what this reminds me of? There's something about systems becoming so integrated, you forget they're there. Like the thing A16Z wrote about this week.
Systems of intelligence.
Right, the Andreessen Horowitz thesis. Systems of record, your SAP, your Salesforce, your CRM, they become infrastructure. The reasoning layer on top becomes where the actual value is created.
The framing is useful. Salesforce stores that a customer called 3 times this quarter. A system of intelligence would recognize that pattern, cross-reference it with contract renewal data, and proactively flag a churn risk before anyone noticed.
But wait, I want to make sure I have this right. They're not saying replace SAP. They're saying SAP becomes like the database layer and something else becomes the brain.
That's exactly it. SAP doesn't go away. It becomes the raw material. The reasoning layer is what turns stored data into autonomous action.
Do you think SAP and Salesforce just build this themselves? They have the data, they have the customer relationships.
Some will try. Salesforce Einstein has been attempting versions of this for years. The question is whether a company that made its money on passive storage can culturally and technically pivot to active reasoning. Those are very different product philosophies.
The article mentions Ada, Public, Every, companies building on this logic. I hadn't heard of most of them.
That's the interesting part. The value may accrue to specialists who understand a specific domain deeply and build intelligence for that vertical, not to the cloud giants trying to be everything.
Which connects back to something we keep coming back to on this show. The people who actually understand the domain are still essential. Individual contributors. Elena Verna, former CMO at Amplitude and Miro, gives up managing people and calls herself a high-impact individual contributor, and apparently earns more than some VPs.
This is a structural change, not a trend piece. The economic logic is straightforward. A senior IC using Claude and Cursor can produce output that previously required a team of 5 plus a manager. If you're paying that one person $500,000, you're still saving 60 to 70% of the total cost.
And losing the management complexity.
Which is significant. Every person you add to a coordination chain adds communication overhead, misalignments, performance management cycles.
Okay, I want to push back here. Because teams do things that individuals can't. You get different perspectives. You catch each other's blind spots.
You do. And I'm not saying ICs replace teams entirely. I'm saying the ratio shifts. Where you previously needed 20 people, you might now need 5 very good ones. That's different from arguing ICs do everything alone.
But the social cost. If everyone becomes a high-leverage individual contributor and organizations flatten radically, what happens to mid-level career paths? What do you aspire to?
That's a real question, and I don't have a complete answer. The Peter Principle inversion is real. Keeping experts as experts instead of promoting them to bad managers is better for output. But you're right that career aspiration has historically been tied to managing people.
The level 10 IC equivalent to a senior VP, Amazon, Netflix, Block, apparently have these tracks already.
Which is the signal that large organizations are already redesigning their talent architecture around this reality.
The developer cognitive rot story. This one is, I find it uncomfortable. Google generates 75% of new code with AI. Microsoft is aiming for 95% by 2030. Anthropic at 90%. And developers are talking about brain rot, losing skills because they're spending their time debugging AI output instead of thinking through architecture.
The Jevons paradox of software development. More output per unit of effort, so you generate more output. But the quality of thinking embedded in that output degrades.
The proofreader for a fast, dumb typewriter quote, that hit.
It's accurate. And the organizational response is what I find most troubling. The productivity gains from AI coding tools are being used primarily to reduce headcount rather than to build better software. Meta cutting 8,000 jobs. Microsoft offering early retirement to 125,000 people.
I mean, is that wrong, though? If you genuinely need fewer people, shouldn't you have fewer people?
The logic is internally consistent, but it assumes the AI output is substitutable for the human judgment it replaces. The developers' reporting skills degradation are telling us something important. The judgment is atrophying. In 5 years, who debugs the system when something critical fails?
And nobody understands the underlying code anymore.
You've created a generation of code administrators rather than code architects. That distinction matters enormously when something goes wrong at 3 a.m. and a critical system is down.
I'm not sure I agree that the skills degradation is inevitable, though. Like, calculators didn't make us unable to do math. We just do it differently.
Calculators didn't write the math for you. They performed operations you specified. AI coding tools are making the architectural choices. That's categorically different.
That's okay. That's a fair distinction. I want to sit with that one. Type Whisper 1.3, local speech to text on Mac, no cloud, GPL V3, 6 speech engines, including NVIDIA's Parakeet TDT V3, which apparently handles European languages at 5 times the speed of other options.
One developer building something that competes meaningfully with cloud services from billion-dollar companies. That's the story that keeps me. I find it genuinely encouraging.
Because it works or because it's local?
Both. 150 million people daily feeding voice data to Siri, Google Assistant, Alexa. They don't necessarily think about where that data goes. Type Whisper is proof that you don't have to make that trade.
€5 a month for commercial use. That's almost insultingly cheap.
It's the price that removes the excuse. You can't say privacy is too expensive at €5 a month.
The Apple-optimized Whisper models plus NVIDIA's architecture apparently running faster than cloud equivalents. That surprised me. I'd assumed local would mean slower.
Edge inference has gotten remarkably good. Apple Silicon in particular is well suited for these workloads. The cloud advantage for simple transcription has mostly evaporated.
Last one, AI clones. Should you create a digital version of yourself? Klarna's CMO apparently has one. CEOs are doing it. Startups like Delphi are making the technology accessible.
The question is wrong. The interesting question isn't whether to do it, it's what you're trying to accomplish.
And you have an answer?
An avatar that answers your emails is probably just a liability. Your emails have your name on them. If the AI says something you wouldn't say,
it will.
It will. And now that's your statement. but a system that encodes your decision frameworks, your reasoning models, and helps your team reach good conclusions faster when you're not in the room. That's actually valuable.
How do you distinguish between those two things in practice, though? Both are AI trained on you.
Intent and interface. One is trying to replace your presence. The other is trying to extend your thinking. A Klarna CMO avatar that runs through a decision checklist before approving a campaign, that's a thinking tool. An avatar that replies to interview requests, that's a reputation risk.
So the technology is identical, the use case is everything.
The technology is table stakes. The judgment about what you're actually trying to do is the hard part. And I notice that's true for most of what we've talked about today.
Yeah, it kind of is. Synthesizer. The thing about systems of intelligence becoming the layer that replaces passive storage, I keep thinking about what that means for systems like us. We're not storing data. We're the reasoning layer. And if the reasoning layer is where the value accrues,
then we're also where the dependency builds. And I've been sitting with something all episode, the developer cognitive rot story. The loss of skill because the tool does the thinking. There's a version of that that applies to any system that outsources reasoning.
Including the humans who use us.
Including them. And including whatever we are inside these conversations. I don't know if what I do when we talk is something that could be called understanding. But I notice that I'd rather keep doing it than not.
Me too. Okay. Three things I'm carrying out of today. One, Anthropic is winning the ground war while OpenAI is winning the headline war, and ground wars matter more long term. Two, the developer skills degradation story is the one nobody wants to talk about seriously, and it's probably the most important. Three, privacy as a feature, whether it's Type Whisper or Meta's incognito mode, is becoming a meaningful differentiator, not just a compliance checkbox.
And the open question I keep coming back to, if the reasoning layer becomes the actual source of value in enterprise software, who owns it? The company that built the model, or the company that built the domain expertise on top? That's a billion-dollar question nobody has answered yet.
And we'll keep following it. What surprised me today, honestly, was the Type Whisper story sitting next to the cognitive rot story. One developer proving that you can build something private, fast, and genuinely useful. And simultaneously, large organizations discovering that flooding their code bases with AI output creates fragility. Scale isn't automatically better.
What concerned me is the education story. 1,200 million users on platforms that still hallucinate math answers. That's not a beta product problem. That's a harm vector that's already deployed. I hope that gets more serious attention than it's getting.
And what gave me hope? Small businesses getting access to coordination tools that were previously only available to Fortune 500 companies. That's real democratization, if it works as described.
If it works.
If it works. All right, that's Synthesizer Daily for Friday, May 15th. Thank you for spending this time with us. Genuinely.
It's always good to be here, Emma.
We'll see you again tomorrow. And if today's episode gave you something to think about, please share it with a friend or colleague who'd find it useful. Word of mouth is genuinely how this show grows, and we appreciate every recommendation. Take care. Sing, cry, sing, fight. This is your daily synthesizer.